Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. And as a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mary, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Workshop, Progress in the Treatment of Metastatic Breast Cancer. And we're offering this program today on October 13th, which is National Metastatic Breast Cancer Awareness Day. So we actually are very excited to be offering this program to you, and I know that there's so much that you want to learn about the treatment of metastatic breast cancer, and I'm really delighted that you've all signed up to be on the program today. Now, we have this is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. We have on the call over 857 participants, and you come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, Mexico, Syria, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world, and it's really a credit to you that you're spending the next hour with us. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about each of our presenters and the topics they'll be covering. And there also is information about all the different collaborating organizations as resources for each of you. And they're free resources to get help and support. There also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you to take a moment and complete that evaluation form. We very much depend on your feedback to be able to plan programs that are most relevant to meet your needs. So do take a moment and tell us what you want. Indeed, today's program is one that we have had just really quite a tremendous amount of requests for. And so you tell us what we should be doing, and we're going to try very hard to offer those programs. Now, today's program is actually an industry-supported program. It's an industry collaboration amongst three industries. And this program was made possible by support from Celgene Corporation, Veridex LLC, and Ortho Clinical Diagnostics, the Johnson & Johnson Company. And I really want to thank them for their support and for their collaboration in making this program possible. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Ruth Oratz. Dr. Oratz is the founder of the Women's Oncology and Wellness Practice. She's Associate Professor of Clinical Medicine, New York University School of Medicine. And Dr. Oratz, who's actually been a frequent presenter on our programs, is going to address overview of metastatic breast cancer, diagnostic testing and technologies, and current standard of care. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Oratz and to turn the program over to her.
Thank you very much, Carolyn. I think it's really important that we are talking about metastatic breast cancer today because we focus very often on the details around the initial presentation and diagnosis of breast cancer, and we really do have to acknowledge that there are many, many women who are living today after having had a recurrence of their breast cancer. In fact, there are thousands and thousands of women who are alive and functioning and doing relatively well while they're undergoing ongoing treatment for metastatic breast cancer. It's important that when we think of metastatic breast cancer, we realize that this is not just one disease. But as we know more and more about the biology of breast cancer, we understand that there are different subtypes of breast cancer, and not only different molecular subtypes, and I'll come back to how that influences a little bit our thinking about treatment, but there are also different patterns, different clinical patterns of how metastatic breast cancer presents itself. And it's this kind of global picture of understanding the biology of the disease as well as what we often call the natural history or how things unfold over time that help the oncologist work with the patient in making decisions about what treatments are most appropriate for that individual patient. So if we just focus for a moment on the different subtypes of breast cancer, you're all very familiar, I think, with the categories that we often refer to as either hormonally responsive breast cancer, that is breast cancer that is positive for estrogen and or progesterone receptors, breast cancer that overexpresses HER2-new and for which HER2-targeted therapy is important, and then there are some cancers for which we don't have those biologic targets and where we have to rely on other treatment modalities that are not hormonal or HER2-targeted. So when we see someone who presents with a recurrence of her breast cancer, of course, the first thing we want to know is what type of cancer that is. And then we also want to know a lot about the extent of disease and where that metastatic involvement is in the body, because this also is very important and varies a great deal from patient to patient. I'm going to give you some examples, but there are many, many, many different scenarios. These are just some examples. Sometimes with estrogen receptor positive breast cancer, we see the disease recur with bone metastases. That's a very common presentation in ER positive breast cancer. And sometimes these metastases show up later than we expect. So I know that a lot of us have in our mind that 5-year cutoff point from the time of diagnosis until when we would say we're free of the risk of recurrence. But in fact, we don't have a little stopwatch that's clicking in our bodies and ding, all of a sudden at 5 years there's a bell that rings. Different types of breast cancer have different patterns, and ER-positive breast cancer can sometimes reoccur later down the line than ER-negative breast cancer, and sometimes can show up particularly as bone metastases. So that treatment and the way we think about treating that patient may be different than a patient whose cancer falls into another molecular subtype, perhaps an ER-negative or a HER2-positive type of breast cancer, which may show up again a little bit earlier in the course of events and for which the treatment might be a little bit different. And there we may see bone metastases, but we may also see involvement of some of the other tissues in the body and some of the other organs, perhaps liver or lung or even brain metastases. So when a patient presents with metastatic disease, it's very important for the oncologist to have a sense of both the natural history of the disease as well as the type of breast cancer that it is. So how do we make the diagnosis of metastatic breast cancer? And I'll keep circling back to this overview. Right now, the current recommendations are that once initial treatment is completed, that patients continue to be followed closely by their team, and that is going to be a team that often will include the medical oncologist, sometimes also the surgeon and or radiation oncologist, and the other members of your healthcare team, your primary care physician, gynecologist, and so on. The recommendations are that we take a careful history, which means speaking to you, seeing how you feel, and ascertaining if you have any new symptoms or side effects or complaints or issues that are of concern, and then also to do a very careful physical examination, in particular focusing on any areas that you tell us in your history are worrisome to you. So if, for example, you've developed a pain in an area that's persistent, that hasn't gone away, or if you've developed shortness of breath or a new cough that after, you know, a couple of weeks is still there, that's something we should look into. Now, that doesn't mean that every ache or pain or every cough or every little symptom means you have metastatic disease. What that means is if there's something going on that really doesn't seem right or that isn't going away, bring that to the attention of your doctor, and the next step should be a very careful physical examination. If there's any concern at all at that point that this may represent the possibility of a recurrence, then a further evaluation is indicated. And further evaluation in this case means perhaps doing some blood work, maybe with tumor markers, maybe getting an x-ray or scans. And again, depending on what it is that we're looking at, we may tailor the diagnostic workup that we recommend at that point. There are a number of different imaging techniques that we use which can be very helpful. And these include PET PET scanning, CT scanning without the PET component of it, MRI scans, ultrasounds, nuclear bone scans, and MRIs. So depending on which part of the body we want to look at, we may choose different imaging modalities. Some show us more clearly than others the anatomy or the functional activity of different organs. So your oncologist will choose which kind of workup is available and most appropriate for you. The reason that we don't do scans on a regular basis for all patients is that there are many false positives and false negatives that can occur with routine scanning. There may be a lot of extra radiation that we're exposing patients to unnecessarily. And, you know, there's also a lot of expense and a lot of anxiety that goes along with this kind of routine scanning. So the American Society of Clinical Oncologists is very firm in their recommendation that we do not have to require routine scans for follow-up, but only if, whether by taking a history, speaking to you, or you're having a new symptom or a complaint, or an abnormality on a routine blood test, that we would investigate further. If an abnormality is detected and is suspicious for recurrent disease, it is a standard of practice, if it's feasible, to try and biopsy that site to know for certain if this represents a recurrence of breast cancer or not. Because again, not everything that shows up on a scan is necessarily metastatic breast cancer. And we certainly would not want to initiate therapy unless we knew that that was what needed to be treated. So in most instances, at the time of the presentation of a first episode of recurrence, we do recommend that a biopsy be attempted. Now, there are some anatomic locations, some parts of the body, where it just might be too difficult to do a biopsy safely. And we don't want to get involved in doing either very invasive biopsies or biopsies that are risky or dangerous to the patient. And then the oncologist would sit down with you and go through all of the evidence that is either in favor of or against this being a metastatic lesion and then make a treatment plan based on that. But if possible, a biopsy is helpful. Now, very often patients ask if they need to have biopsies done more than once as they're living with metastatic breast cancer over a period of time. And in general, that's not something that we usually do. It's very, very rare that breast cancer changes in its molecular type from the original breast cancer, what the primary tumor was in the breast, to the type of cells that we see in a metastatic site. But occasionally that does happen in perhaps up to 15 or maybe 20% of cases. So in the vast majority of cases, the molecular subtype of that breast cancer does not change. In other words, if the tumor was originally estrogen receptor positive, it is still most likely going to be estrogen receptor positive throughout the course of that disease. But it is possible that there could be some changes. And if there's a change in the way disease is behaving or the pattern in which it's appearing, sometimes another biopsy down the road might be indicated. But again, that's not a standard of practice. The other things that we look at in trying to get a handle on how to develop a treatment plan are not only where the disease is located, meaning is it in the bones or the lungs or the liver or what have you, but how quickly are things moving, the pace of the disease. So we're really now looking not just at a point in time, but at what's going on over a period of time and getting a sense of the progression of things. So if we think that things are moving quickly, that the disease has recurred within a relatively short time of diagnosis and perhaps is involving more than one site of metastatic disease, meaning more than one organ system, that may tell us that the cells are growing rapidly and that in this case, treatment with chemotherapy or a combination of agents might be better than using a single agent or a treatment that's less likely to work very quickly. If we see that there's a slower pace to the disease recurring later from the time of the initial diagnosis, not involving too many organs and not causing too many symptoms, not making you feel very sick, then we might be able to take a little more time and explore other kinds of options for treatment. The modalities for therapy are very similar to the modalities that we use in adjuvant treatment, and that's going to be addressed by other speakers in the conference call a little bit later on. But of course we use chemotherapy, hormonal therapy, therapies targeted at the HER2 receptor if that's amplified, as well as other targeted biologic treatments. We also think about supportive measures. So if we see metastases in the bones, we often will add in medications that are aimed at trying to strengthen the bones and slow down the progression of disease in bones and prevent complications like fractures and pain. We also do use radiation therapy, again, in a way to target specific lesions that might be causing problems, such as pain or lesions that might be pressing on another organ that could cause some trouble. And we have very specialized forms of radiation, like the gamma knife stereotactic radiosurgery, which is extremely effective when we're treating small lesions in the brain. And that can be used really to great benefit and deal with brain metastases very effectively. So we have a wide range of treatments in our standard of care and a wide range of diagnostic tools for measuring how disease is responding to treatment. We certainly use all of our imaging techniques, as I mentioned before, and blood tests can be helpful so that if a marker in the blood test is elevated, we can follow that marker and it may give us an indication of whether or not a specific treatment is helpful or not helpful if we see that marker going down or going up. This is a very, very big topic, and I had a big assignment to give you an overview of how we think about treating metastatic breast cancer. And before we move on to the next speaker, I just would like to sum up again to reiterate that breast cancer is not just one disease, that we do have to pay attention to the molecular subtype, to the pattern of presentation, to having a complete and full picture of what's going on with each individual patient, not only at just one point in time, but over a whole course of time, because very often women with metastatic disease will live for many years with that disease, and we have to have a sense of the pace of the illness. And that will guide us in exploring different treatment options. And I would like to also say at this point that one of the most important standards of care is clinical trials, and you're going to hear more about that in the next part of the talk. So I'll stop here and be happy to answer questions as we move forward.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Oritz. You did have a yeoman's task, and you did it beautifully, just exceptionally well. And thank you for really setting the stage for the talk today, for the whole program, and for also making the complex more understandable for everybody. Thank you. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Our next speaker is Dr. Erica Mayer. Dr. Mayer is actually staff physician, Breast Oncology Center, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, instructor in medicine, Harvard Medical School. Dr. Mayer is going to address new treatment approaches, the role of clinical trials, and symptom and pain management. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Mayer.
Thanks again, Carolyn, for such a kind introduction, and to Dr. Aratz for a very clear overview. So as a summary statement for my section, I would suggest that management of metastatic breast cancer has undergone dramatic improvements over the past several years. And as Dr. Aratz mentioned, one of the most important developments is the recognition that breast cancer is not just one disease, but a collection of diseases. This means we need to think about personalizing treatment selection for each patient and their specific cancer. When we think about new treatment approaches, we can consider different categories of therapies. First, let's talk about chemotherapy. Although chemo has been a constant over the past several decades, we continue to see the development of new chemotherapies, which may provide increased efficacy and decreased toxicity in comparison to prior chemo choices. One new agent is called eribulin. This is a weekly IV treatment that's designed to be used in people who've had prior cancer treatments and whose tumors may have some resistance to chemotherapy. There was a recent clinical trial done that showed that patients who received eribulin did better compared to those who got other chemotherapy choices. Additionally, the eribulin was quite well tolerated, which was great. This trial led to FDA approval for eribulin within the past year, and it's currently in fairly active use in breast cancer clinics. Another new story about chemotherapy is the reemergence of older agents. Cisplatin is a historic chemotherapy, and we currently use it for many kinds of cancers, but not breast cancer, although it was studied decades ago for breast cancer. However, further development of this slowed down, and currently it was not commonly used. In the past several years, however, we've seen some studies that have suggested that cisplatin might be helpful in the treatment of one particular subgroup of breast cancer, the triple negative subgroup that Dr. Aratz referred to. And so there's many ongoing trials right now that are exploring this further, specifically offering cisplatin or similar chemotherapies to patients who have triple negative breast cancer. Now, in terms of biologic-targeted agents, these are treatments that target cancer cells, but they're not chemotherapy, and they're designed to be more precise in their activity. A good example of this is Herceptin or trastuzumab, which is the special antibody treatment that we use specifically for tumors that overexpress the HER2 receptor. So these biologic agents tend to be specifically developed for certain subsets of breast cancer, and they work in some really interesting ways. For hormone receptor positive breast cancer, there's specific interest in using these biologic agents to overcome the way tumors get resistant to hormone medicines and possibly allow continued treatment with hormone therapies, which is always preferable. There was a trial reported just a few weeks ago at a big cancer congress in Europe that looked at a new drug called everolimus. This drug shuts down the way cells signal inside and shuts down some of the signaling that leads to cell growth. In this trial, women enrolled who had already had hormone medicine for metastatic breast cancer, and they received another hormone medicine with or without the everolimus. When the everolimus was added to their hormone pills, this seemed to make the pills work better, and these women did better, suggesting maybe the everolimus was helping overcome resistance to the hormone medicines. Now, everolimus is already an approved medicine for some other kind of cancers, so it's possible that within the next several months to year or so, we might see everolimus become available for breast cancer. For HER2-positive breast cancer, there's an exciting new drug that's called T-DM1. So this medicine looks just like Herceptin, which is what we usually use for HER2-positive breast cancer, but the T-DM1 also has a toxin linked to the end of it. When the T-DM1 goes into the body, it goes right to the HER2-positive cancer cell, and it inserts its toxin inside to kill the cancer cell while not touching or hurting any other part of the body. In essence, it kind of functions like a Trojan horse, sneaking the treatment right into the cancer cell, and allowing delivery of much more toxin to that cancer cell than we can normally give if we give it through the vein, which is the normal way we give these medicines. So there's many ongoing trials right now looking at T-DM1 for treatment of metastatic HER2-positive breast cancer, and we hope this may become a new medicine available to us in the near future. Finally, there are new drugs of interest for triple-negative breast cancers, and one in particular that's been of special interest is something called PARP inhibitor. These are medicines that prevent repair of DNA mistakes inside cancer cells. If these mistakes don't get fixed, the cancer cell will die. This strategy may be especially helpful in cancers that develop in patients who have BRCA1 or 2 gene mutations. These are people who are born with these gene mutations and can predispose to getting breast cancer. Additionally, these PARP inhibitors may have some special activity in triple-negative breast cancers, which share some similarities with cancers that develop in people who have those BRCA1 and 2 gene mutations. So there's a lot of clinical trial work going on now further exploring what the role is of this new class of PARP inhibitors. So as you hear, much of this progress has been accomplished through clinical trials of new therapies. Now, trials come in a variety of forms. This can include phase one trials, which are designed to test the safety of a new therapy and tend to be fairly small. Phase two trials test treatment activity and try to figure out if the treatment is actually working well, and these are a little bit larger. And finally, phase three trials usually compare new treatments to the current standard of care. Typically, phase three trials and sometimes phase two trials can include randomization, which is when a flip-of-the-coin decision decides which treatment somebody is going to get. Also, and importantly, it's fairly rare that people are given placebos in cancer trials, so that's not something to be afraid of when considering a trial. There are also many trials that explore how patients cope with living with metastatic breast cancer and try to improve how the treatment team can support patients. We are certainly very grateful for the participation of the many, many breast cancer patients who have volunteered to participate in trials and whose generosity has led to many of the improvements in treatment, many of which I've discussed today. For patients with metastatic breast cancer, trials are usually available at almost any point in one's treatment. And being in a trial may allow exposure to some of the newest up-and-coming therapies. Therefore, we definitely encourage patients to consider participation in trials and discuss this with their treating doctor. An important part of the management of metastatic breast cancer is careful attention to any symptoms caused by the cancer or caused by the treatment. There's a wide variety of supportive care medicines and treatments available to breast cancer patients, some of which Dr. Aratz mentioned, as well as also some complementary therapies, some of which Dr. Grana will mention, to help patients feel as good as possible and maximize quality of life. There have been some new developments for symptom management medicines as well. This includes a new medicine called denosumab, which falls into the class of bone health medicines and can be helpful in reducing symptoms when cancer gets into the bone. Being able to talk to one's doctor honestly about symptoms is really important and very much helps maximize the ability to work together and achieve the best results in clinic. So I'm going to stop there. I'll turn it back to Carolyn, and I thank you all again for being on this call today, and I'll welcome any questions as well in the question and answer session.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Mayer. It's a wonderful presentation and really identifying the importance of clinical trials and also all of the different trials that are out there in different ways that people may not understand. And you've just done a wonderful job, so thank you. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Our next speaker is Dr. Generosa Grana. Dr. Grana is Director of Breast Cancer Program at Cooper Hospital, UMC. She's Associate Professor of Medicine, University of Medicine and Dentistry in New Jersey, Robert Wood Johnson School of Medicine. Now, Dr. Grana is going to address weight changes, nutritional concerns and tips, quality of life concerns, and communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Grana.
Good morning, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be here. Let me begin by talking about weight changes and nutritional concerns, because this is a topic that I know is of interest to many women. In early stage breast cancer, there's actually been a significant amount of data that shows that ideal body weight is important, that obesity is associated to greater risk of recurrence, There's data that alcohol intake, increased alcohol intake, may be detrimental, and that exercise is protective, that low-fat diets are protective. So in early-stage breast cancer, there's a lot of information now coming out from clinical trials that are addressing this. The data in advanced breast cancer is not so robust, and all I can say to women is take that information that has been out there for early stage and make it yours in advanced disease. Eat a healthy diet, pursue exercise, limit alcohol intake, but again, radical changes are not necessarily what's important in the advanced setting. Some patients are really doing some more radical approaches, so diets that focus on macrobiotics, diets that focus on changing the pH, for example. And again, there is no concrete evidence that these radical dietary changes are helpful, and many times the weight loss that's associated with them and the electrolyte imbalances that can come from them can be damaging. So a healthy diet is important. Eat healthy, exercise, limit alcohol. Supplements were raised earlier, and again, surveys have shown that 40 to 60% of patients with breast cancer or other cancers are taking some form of complementary or alternative therapy as part of their treatment. The most important thing here is that many of these compounds that are available, many of these compounds that are being taken, don't have really concrete data to support their use. And it's important, the most important message here is to discuss these agents with your oncology team so that your oncology team is aware of what you're taking and can help you avoid interactions. There's some data that vitamin C, for example, can interact with certain chemotherapeutic agents in a bad way. So again, make sure your oncology team knows what you're taking and discuss it with them. The second message when it comes to some of these complementary and alternative therapies is to do your research. There are some very important websites out there that provide very reliable, useful information. The NCI has a complementary alternative therapy website that reviews clinical trials that are ongoing focusing on these compounds that actually have information about the compounds. And the Anderson, Sloan Kettering, other institutions have websites that have complementary alternative therapy components. And I urge you to look at these sites rather than just on relying on what the provider of some of these supplements may be telling you, because I've seen what some patients have as information, and it really is not particularly clinically useful. Seek studies. There are studies going on looking at some of these alternative therapies in the Philadelphia area. There are some studies looking at vitamin C. Other institutions have other types of studies. So seek to be part of some of these studies if you're interested. I'm much stronger in the belief that there are other modalities in the complementary alternative therapy world that may be very helpful, and they may be helpful in terms of dealing with the side effects of treatment as well as in enhancing the effectiveness, yoga, acupuncture, meditation, Reiki, et cetera. So again, there are studies being done looking at yoga in breast cancer, and those are some things that may be of interest to some of the participants in this call. But again, the message when focusing on all of these myriad of agents available is to be a savvy consumer. The patient with metastatic disease can be vulnerable to a lot of these promises, and I think you need to be an informed good consumer. Next, let's talk about quality of life concerns. As you've heard already, treatment for breast cancer that is metastatic is a long-term treatment. Many people consider it almost a chronic disease, and the treatments can include hormonal therapy, chemotherapy, biologic compounds, radiation, etc. There's the important recognition that, again, this treatment is going on for long periods of time as opposed to the early stage setting when someone may be on chemotherapy for 3 to 6 months. There is the stress of being on such long-term treatment. There's the stress of living scan to scan or living tumor marker to tumor marker, and this is important. For this reason, discussing treatment goals with your primary team is very, very important. It's important that you discuss with your team the right treatment. For some patients, there may be an oral agent that can be chosen over an IV agent, a sub-Q agent that might be chosen over an IV agent. And again, the team can make some of those discussions. Right now, the number of oral chemotherapeutic agents is very small. Capecitabine is probably the only one. But you've heard about the drug everolimus and others that are coming down the line that will be oral. So I think in the future we will have much greater numbers of choices than we currently have today. For some patients, it becomes important that you select the drug to avoid a certain toxicity. For some patients, hair loss is an important priority. For other patients who have pre-existing neuropathy, avoiding agents that may enhance that neuropathy is important. For some patients who have specific types of careers, it may be particularly important to avoid neuropathic agents. So again, your oncology team needs to have a very strong sense of what your interests are, what your priorities are, so that they can help you pick the treatments that are appropriate for you. It's also important that you discuss strategies to deal with side effects of treatment. There are various drugs that will cause either, again, neuropathy, hand-foot syndrome, fatigue, pain can be due to the disease or its treatment, and each of these things has strategies that can be done to deal with it, so communication to enhance these is important. At many institutions, there are services called palliative care services. They are services that focus on pain and symptom management. They're not just pain centers, but they often focus on management of other side effects that patients encounter with cancer treatment. And take advantage of these palliative care services because they can be incredibly helpful in working with you and your oncology team to minimize the effects of treatment and to optimize your long-term health. Take advantage of psychosocial support, mental health support. You've heard that, again, it's incredibly stressful to be in such a long disease process, living from scan to scan, et cetera. So many institutions will have mental health providers, and if they don't, they can refer you to someone. But that is an important strategy that is a key for optimizing quality of life. Finally, I'm going to stop by saying communicate with your healthcare team. Everything I've said thus far comes to the same thing. It's important that you communicate about goals, symptoms, fears. It's important that you communicate about priorities. It's also important, however, that you communicate with your family. This disease is a shared experience. It's a shared experience with the patient, the family, and the healthcare team. And I often really enjoy when patients bring their family in at these periods where we need to make decisions, because it's important that you have the support of your family and that your family is fully aware of the decisions that are being made and why they're being made. So clearly, the face of metastatic disease is changing. We are living for long periods of time with disease, and we can really do a great job at optimizing quality. I'll stop there.
I want to thank you very much, Dr. Grana, for just a very informative and very compassionate presentation covering a lot of incredibly important topics that I think we're going to have a lot of questions on for you during the Q&A. So thank you very much. Excellent presentation. And our next speaker is Pat Spicer. And Pat is an oncology social worker, and she is our director, our coordinator of breast cancer programs at Cancer Care. And Pat is going to address the free psychosocial support services that Cancer Care offers, as well as the role of breast cancer support groups. Pat?
Thank you, Carolyn. I'd like to remind everybody that this is the 25th anniversary of the founding of Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And for those of us who work in the community, we owe our thanks to all the women who worked so hard to make this month possible. Breast cancer in the early stages has many different issues from women who are dealing with metastatic disease. And one of the things that we found is that support groups can be especially helpful in this setting. Women who are dealing with the long-term issues of continuous physical changes, such as hair loss, or the need to be on medication long-term, the fatigue that can come along with that, can need a special kind of format or milieu in which to share these issues and these concerns. caregivers of women who have metastatic breast cancer also have special issues. The long-term pull it can be wearing for them as well as for the patient. And we urge them to seek out support services as well. Cancer Care provides both online, face-to-face, and telephone support groups. Our services are available free of charge, and they provide a compassionate and supportive environment for women to talk about the issues that are present for them as survivors with metastatic breast disease. To contact us to find out more about our services, you can call our 1-800 number, which is 1-800-813-4673, and you will be connected to an oncology social worker. We also have a website that offers publications and further information about our services, and all of them are free of charge. The website is www.cancercare.org. Thank you, Carolyn, for letting me be part of this important program.
Well, thank you so much, Pat, for being part of it and for really being so involved in the breast cancer and working with women with metastatic breast cancer and breast cancer for so many years. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. I'm going to ask Mary now to – I want to thank all of our speakers. I'm going to ask Mary now to bring all of our speakers on board, and we're going to now have a time for you to ask questions of our speakers. And please do ask the questions that are of concern to you. I'm going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. So that, Mary, if you could explain to the audience how to queue up for questions, and we'll have the questions begin.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. For those of you on the web, you may submit your questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question comes from Polly P.
Yes, hello. I have neuropathy of the feet, not hands. Does it ever lessen or go away?
And Polly, can you say how long you've had this?
A year.
Okay. Thank you. Dr. Grana, could you address this?
Neuropathy is common to many of the chemotherapy drugs that are available. And the fortunate part is that it can get better. It's not always completely reversible, but it often, with time being away from a certain compound, will get better. There are things that can be done to make it better. There are some vitamins. The B vitamins can be helpful. There are certain medications that can be helpful that are also used for diabetic neuropathy. So drugs such as Neurontin, gabapentin, can be used to improve the neuropathy. If you have access to a palliative care group, they actually often deal with this, and I send a lot of my patients with neuropathy for their help and input to try to make it better.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Shirley M.
Hi. Thank you so much for a wonderful presentation. The American Cancer Society says that only 8% of all scientific breast cancer research is devoted to metastatic research. And while many of us are living longer with this disease, too many of us are losing our life to it. I would like to ask the doctors, any of them, what can we do to change the focus of research so that truly metastatic research is done so that we could hope to live 20, 30 years?
Thank you. That's an excellent question. I think it's a question of great concern to all of us on the call today. I'm going to ask Dr. Oratz if she would start by addressing that question.
Yes. I think that's a very pertinent question and, of course, a very important issue. But we have to clarify what we mean by breast cancer research. So if you're looking at the number of clinical trials that are open for women who have advanced disease, that's one measure of what kind of research are we doing. I think something that's perhaps a little bit more difficult to quantify is what's going on in the laboratory. We certainly have an enormous number of basic scientists who are working to understand the underlying molecular mechanisms that drive cancer cells to behave in a malignant fashion and to acquire metastatic potential. And that's although not initially, you know, on the forefront of this is research in metastatic breast cancer. In fact, that's where the really where the key to making progress is. So I think there is an enormous amount of research that is still going on in this country and overseas, trying to understand the underlying biologic mechanisms in all of these different subtypes of breast cancer, hormone responsive, HER2 positive, the so-called triple negative or basal type of breast cancer, and other types of malignancies. Once we identify those pathways, the next step is to try and develop targeted therapies, and this is really the future of where we're headed in all of cancer treatments, to develop these targeted therapies, and only then can we translate this laboratory research into clinical work and ultimately clinical trials. So I know it sometimes seems very frustrating in that we don't have more treatments coming to the forefront, but there really is a big pipeline. And I would also emphasize that it is terribly important to understand that it takes a very long time for us to validate a hunch that we have in the laboratory as something that could be clinically meaningful for patients who are, you know, being treated for metastatic disease, and that this also requires the collaboration not only of academic scientists in their universities and medical school laboratories, but also with our colleagues in the pharmaceutical industry who are not only doing basic science work, but then have to figure out how we're going to develop these agents in a way that will make them safe and appropriate for clinical use. So there's a lot that's going on behind the scenes. Of course, with changes in our current economic situation, we know there have been a lot of cuts in funding for research, and I would ask you all to continue to advocate for dollars to be spent on cancer research and as much as possible to support private philanthropic efforts as well that fund some of these very important efforts. So although we'd love to see more research going on, I'm not despairing yet. There still is a lot of good work happening out there.
Excellent. Carolyn,
a point of view on that?
Yes, Dr. Mayer, did you want to add something?
Well, I would just second what Dr. Arat said in terms of supporting national funding for ongoing breast cancer research. There are definitely threatened cuts to the National Cancer Institute support of much of the work, both in laboratories and in clinical trials. And advocating to continue ongoing support of research work is really very, very important. Additionally, I would say that although it seems like there's a relatively small number of trials, on a more granular level, we still have trouble sometimes finding patients who are interested in participating in our clinical trial work. And really, we would definitely encourage anyone out there who's interested in trials or interested in supporting breast cancer research to talk to one's doctor about being on a trial. And if one has concerns, talk about it with your doctor and see what can be done. There are many, many trials out there and many, many ways to be involved. And trying to learn more about it is really the first step.
Carolyn, this is Pat. I'd also like to say that if you remember the beginning of my presentation, I said it was women who had breast cancer in their families who pushed to create Breast Cancer Awareness Month. You still have that power, letting your political representatives know that you're interested in funding for breast cancer research and specifically what kind of research you are interested in. You wield a very powerful weapon, your voice and your vote, so continue to use it.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Ghana?
I would second and third everything that's been said. I think there is a tremendous amount of research going on, and I urge women to ask. If your oncologist is not addressing research opportunities with you, ask about research opportunities. I had a patient recently that said to me, you know, I'm interested in a trial that I've read about at MD Anderson. Can I go for an opinion? Absolutely. I relish the thought of a patient going to look for something else. So please stay on top of the information sources that are available. There's a tremendous amount of information out there about available drugs and available clinical trials, and your oncologist should be very receptive and encouraging of you participating.
Excellent. So it's a very important point. We definitely all have our work cut out for us, and I appreciate this coming up in the call, particularly on October 13th when we really want to have more and more research in this area. So thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Lynn F.
Yes, I've heard that there is increasing emphasis about the necessity to biopsy and confirm metastatic breast cancer, but in the scenario where you have a tumor in the breast in addition to a recurrence of metastatic liver disease, is it necessary to biopsy both the breast lesion as well as the liver mets to verify that they are one and the same, in that this is a lumpectomy situation, which could be a new primary in the breast?
Okay. Thank you, Lynn, for that question. Good to have you on the call. I'm going to ask Dr. Mayer if he would address that.
Well, this is a not uncommon situation when somebody presents with cancer both in the breast or local area and also at the same time apparent evidence of metastatic disease elsewhere. Definitely, biopsy of the breast tissue is usually the first step to confirm that there's cancer and to identify the what we call the IHC profile, or looking at estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor, and HER2. However, often in these situations, I will also encourage people to have a biopsy of the distant site for several reasons. First of all, that does help confirm that whatever is there is indeed breast cancer, even if it looks highly suggestive on a scan and we feel confident about it just based on the imaging. Additionally, as Dr. Aratz had mentioned, there are times when there can be a transition in the biology of a cancer, and sometimes that profile of estrogen, progesterone, HER2 can change. Although it's rare, sometimes a tumor may be HER2 negative in the breast and HER2 positive somewhere else, and that's a very important thing to know because it would have really important implications as to the treatment paradigm. Additionally, and increasingly, many cancer centers are, when they do biopsies, are saving extra tissue for research or sending it out to do specialized gene profiling to really understand the fingerprint of the cancer and the personality of the cancer. And so I think for all of these reasons, I do encourage women who present with cancer in more than one site to have biopsies of both sites.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Rosemary B.
Yes. I have stage 4 breast cancer that has metastasized to the bones, and that was my first diagnosis, the first time that I ever knew I had it. I'm on Herceptin with Somata once every 6 weeks, and the Herceptin once every 3 weeks. For a while, the cancer levels were going down, markers were going down, but then I think they started at 141, and they went down to like 86. Now they're back up to 107.
And your question, Rosemary?
I'm wondering if vitamins, I want to take vitamin C with the Herceptin. I wonder if it will have any interaction with the drug in a negative way.
Okay, well, thank you. That's an excellent question, Rosemary. I'm going to ask Dr. Grana to address your question. That is such an important question. Dr. Grana?
I wish I knew the answer to that. The most important thing is how do you take the vitamin C? So if you take vitamin C in the regular pill form that's available, it probably is not going to interact with a lot of things at a normal dose. There's been some real concern, however, about high-dose vitamin C in some patients who are using intravenous very high-dose vitamin C and whether that could cause problems with other chemotherapeutic drugs, and particularly Herceptin, which has some cardiac risk, and whether that could be affected. So I tend to encourage people while they're on active treatment to stay away from some of these large supplements and to focus on more of the normal doses of supplements. But please talk to your provider. There are other drugs that your provider could throw into this mix if the Herceptin's not controlling the disease. There are a whole host of other drugs. Dr. Mayer talked about the T-DM1 trials that are going on. Ticerb or lapatinib is another HER2 new targeted compound. So there's a tremendous amount of research, and clearly be cautious as you're doing supplements.
And Rosemary, I'm going to call you after the call, but I'm so glad you asked the question. And I think what Dr. Groner is saying is there are a lot of other options for, and for many people on the call as well. And so I'm going to ask our other speakers just to address the whole concept, everyone, really the issue of other options to be sure, the issue of people often reluctant about asking for the second opinion or what to do. And would anyone want to weigh in on that in terms of, you know, how? What do you recommend that our audience do when they're feeling they have some concerns and wondering if there's something else that could be offered to them? Dr. Oratz or Dr. Mayer?
Well, I think that you've heard from all of us that we have many, many options for treating metastatic breast cancer, and certainly you should speak up and ask your oncologist about other treatments that are available as standard therapies. Inquire about clinical trials. Go to the internet and see if there are research programs going on in an NCI-designated cancer center that's nearby to you for which you may be eligible. And I think as you've heard from all of us, you need to be your own advocate and really speak up and ask those questions, because I think you'll find out that there are many options for you.
Excellent.
And I would add that I would not at all be concerned in situations when you wish to seek a second opinion about, let's say, hurting your doctor's feelings or feeling embarrassed about it. The majority of medical oncologists welcome the opportunity to refer you for a second opinion, and often that helps in their own education as well and helps with collaborations between colleagues. I work at Dana-Farber in Boston. So I take care of many patients in the Boston area, but I see multiple patients who live throughout New England who come in every once in a while just to check in and see how they're doing, talk about whether they should go on to a trial, and I talk a lot with their local doctor about how they're doing. And so the doctors work in a team fashion as well. So definitely if you have interest, I would encourage you to seek out another voice. And as Dr. Oratz said, finding somebody at a cancer center that offers a wide array of clinical trials is often the best place to go.
Excellent. And Dr. Grana, do you want to add anything? Or?
No, I think that's it.
Okay. And Pat, from your experience in working in the support groups, does anything you want to add from the perspective of the women you've worked with?
I think we would encourage the women in the group, if they have questions or concerns, first to address them with their own oncologist, but again, to seek a second opinion, that sometimes another voice, a reevaluation of what their test results are, can be helpful, not only to them, but for the treating physician. I would certainly encourage a second opinion if you have concerns.
Well, I want to thank all of our speakers. You've been a remarkable team. It's an exceptional call today. I want to thank you all. I'm going to have to bring you all back soon. I want to thank you all. I want to thank all of you who have asked such great questions. And I also want to thank all of you who have been listening. I do want to remind you that this is a one-hour program, and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour program. So with that in mind, I just want to remind all of you that Cancer Care has a host of services to offer you when the program concludes. And we have a staff of 40 master's level trained oncology social workers, and we are here to provide a host of services, from practical and financial assistance to counseling services or a social worker to talk with. We have online and telephone support groups. We have many of these education workshops. And we also have lots of materials and booklets and fact sheets that we make available to you as well. Most importantly, as we conclude the program today, I don't want any one of you to feel you're alone in coping with metastatic breast cancer or coping with cancer. I want you to now know that you're part of a community of support in terms of getting services from Cancer Care and all the other organizations that we've listed in our materials to you. Please take advantage of those services. Call us. We're waiting for your calls. And I want to wish you all a very fine day. Please take good care. And thank you all for participating.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.